It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Even the best athletes in the world need great coaches. And this hour, we're going to talk about coaching culture from the little leagues to the major leagues. And we want to hear from you this hour. Are you a coach? Tell us about your approach. Did you have a coach that changed your life for better or worse? We'd love to hear your story. But first, a conversation with a coach who's been getting a lot of attention lately. After a nick of time win and a devastating loss in the NCAA men's basketball tournament, UNI coach Ben Jacobson faced the public and the press with his trademark sincerity and support for the men on his team. Here's just a moment from the emotional press conference that was held just after the team lost to Texas A&M.
For them to do what they did, sorry, man, that's what makes it hard. You know, it shouldn't have ended tonight, but maybe it ends next Thursday, you know, or maybe it ends a Saturday. I mean, unless you play that final game, there is an end. And because of the way these guys handled themselves and the leadership that these three guys showed, Sully, the way this one went down, there's no question. This is the hardest one that I've been a part of. But the last thing I would tell you is the reason it's that for me is because these three guys, what they did, and they should be playing next week. And I take responsibility for that not happening. But those three seniors were absolutely awesome.
Again, that's the voice of UNI men's basketball coach Ben Jacobson, and Coach Jake is here with me today. Hello, Coach. On the telephone. Hi, Coach. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, good. Now I can hear you. That's great.
Yeah.
You know, listening to that moment from the press conference, I'm sure you were just as devastated as the men on your team over that loss, but what did you feel your role needed to be at that moment?
You know, the first thing that I thought about, you know, after the final horn had gone off at the end of the second overtime, was just how proud I was of our guys. And a couple things that came immediately to mind, and one you played in the interview afterwards about the three seniors and what those guys had done for our program and how much I had learned from them in terms of leadership and then just how much they believed in each other and believed in what we were doing. You know, those were things that are going to be with them, be with our program, you know, be with me, be with our fans. You know, those things I thought about as I was going back to the locker room. And then the other, you know, aspect of it, well, when the game was tied and went into the first overtime, the guys played so well in that first overtime in circumstances that were so heavily stacked against us, that, you know, it was a real reflection of what the, you know, just of who these guys are. And so I couldn't help but be extremely proud. And so at that point, you know, when you go into the locker room, you know, my job is to one, try to help them understand a little bit about what happened, and then also appreciate everything that we've done over the course of the season, and in particular the 2 months. And that's a hard thing to do when a game goes that way. But nonetheless, you know, my job is to do it the best I can to help them get through what is at that moment a tough time.
When you go to the NCAA tournament, where you've been many times, I mean, the kind of attention that's on your basketball team is different from anything you experience throughout the season. Although, of course, people are watching you throughout the season. But, you know, we look at Paul Jesperson with his amazing buzzer beater three-pointer shot. He's a national hero. And then a few days later, LeBron James is on Twitter saying everybody who plays basketball for UNI should quit basketball. You know, so one day you're a hero, the next day you're absolutely not. How do you prepare these men for that kind of experience?
Yeah, that's that's such a big part, and in a lot of ways, you know, maybe the biggest part of what we do, the understanding. And you know, we talk about it with the guys, you know, as we go through the calendar year. You know, there's a handful of times that we talk about exactly what you just described, and that is, you know, we are have got a tremendous opportunity to do what we do and to be competitive and be on the big stage and be in the, you know, be in the fight, if you will. And that opportunity also comes with, you know, responsibility of, you know, the understanding that sometimes it's going to go great, and we get to appreciate that, and we get to have people tell us how much they enjoyed it and how much they're, you know, enjoying being part of the ride. And then sometimes, guys, it's not going to go great. You know, it's not going to be perfect as you go through your career. We happen to get both sides of it in 48 hours, right? I mean, we happen to get the highest of the highs that we talk about and being able to celebrate them. And we got what is, you know, the lowest of the lows just 48 hours later. And what I've always told our guys is that we're going to handle both sides of it with as much class as we possibly can. We aren't ever going to feel like we get to celebrate all the good stuff, but then act in a different manner when something doesn't go our way. And so that, you know, again, it's, you know, we talk about it a handful of times throughout the course of the year, you know, with some of the other things we talk about that are important to our program and how our young guys represent, you know, our program and our university. And that's one of them. You know, it's you're going to get both sides, and we're going to do everything we can to handle both of them in the same manner.
How would you describe your coaching philosophy?
You know, from a you know, from a personality standpoint, I'm pretty laid back. You know, I enjoy being able to coach the guys at practice. And when I say that, I enjoy coaching the basketball part of it when we're on the practice floor. You know, very rarely do we have a practice or moments in practice where my voice gets any different than it is right now when we're doing our interview. I love having conversations with our guys at practice, you know, asking them about, hey, what do you think about this? And what do you think about, you know, running this play or how we're doing this? When we stop the action, I like being able to talk to them about, you know, you should have been over here a little bit farther, and that's why. And so our practices are much more conversational. And then, you know, occasionally, and I think this is important as well, I actually was talking to my 96-year-old grandfather yesterday. And he said, you know, one of our jobs as parents and one of our jobs as coaches, one of our jobs as leaders is to be able to do what I described, and that's coach them and help them understand why and motivate them. And he said it's also part of our job to kick them in the rear end every once in a while and when they need it and help them understand that, you know, things, again, aren't going to be perfect. And, you know, every once in a while, that's part of my job as well. So... but we spend most of our time. Look, I'm pretty laid back. I'm extremely competitive, and our guys, they understand that and they know that, but they also know that I'm on their side and I want what's best for them. And so we've worked pretty well together.
You know, the NCAA tournament is a great time to really watch coaches and coaching behavior, because you do see people with so many different styles. And you know, you see some very successful coaches out there that are bombastic. They do a lot of yelling. They throw temper tantrums. They get a technical foul every now and again, maybe more often than that. And some of them have a great deal of success with their team. I understand that there's a personality influence here, but do you think that it's also, is there cultural pressure to be like that?
You know, I don't know that it's really as much cultural pressure as it is, you know, the personality and the combination of one's own personality and the competitiveness and the pressure that goes along with running a highly visible, highly successful program, whether it's at the, you know, basketball, you know, whichever sport it is. You know, I just think that personality and competitiveness, when they combine and they clash, it's the thing that I've learned. And you mentioned it. Everybody is going to have their own way of going about it, and people have been successful doing it all different ways. The thing I can tell you is, it is you want your guys to do so well because you know how much time they put in. So you want them to have success. You want them to experience that, and then you want your university, your student body, your fan base. You want everyone that's invested in your program to have success, be able to enjoy that success as well. And that combination of competitiveness and visibility and wanting young guys to do so well, that can bring out the best in us. And at times that I've gotten my technical fouls and had some moments that I wish I could do certainly do different. It brings out every kind of emotion that you've got because, it again, you know how much time your guys invest, and you know how passionate your fans are. And you just, from my standpoint, you really just want, you know, what's going to be best for them.
Did you have a coach that you feel really shaped you?
Yeah, Rich Glass was my college coach at the University of North Dakota, and he recruited me out of high school and had the opportunity to go and play for Coach, and was with just a tremendous group of guys that I still talk to every week, and we still see each other once or twice a year. We get together, and this was, now we're going back 25 years ago now, when, or just about 25 years ago when we were done with college. And but we have that kind of relationship because of the way Coach Glass ran his program. You know, the things he didn't talk much about, he was great in terms of game preparation and offense and defense and scouting and individual improvement. Now, he was a great coach, but he was way better in terms of teaching us about things that matter a lot more than getting better at dribbling and getting better at shooting. You know, he talked all the time about attitude and that we have control over our attitude and the way that we respond to situations. He talked to us about that all the time. And I, you know, when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, you know, after you hear that, you know, almost daily, you start to think, come on, coach, let's talk about something else here. Let's talk about something that's a little more exciting here. When you're now my age at 45 and I've got a wonderful wife and two great boys and, you know, the leader of a basketball program that I'm very proud of, you know, I thank my lucky stars for Coach Glass and that he kept hammering away at us the importance of attitude and, you know, our ability to choose how we're going to respond to all situations. So, you know, I've had some great coaches, but he's the one that's had the most impact.
Coach Jake, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you.
UNI men's basketball coach Ben Jacobson. This hour, we're talking about coaching culture on Talk of Iowa, and you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about coaching culture. And when it comes to kids and sports, a lot of people have a lot of opinions. There are some who think we've gotten too soft when it comes for kids, that everybody gets a medal, everybody gets a trophy. This kind of feeling was summed up in a very funny way on the sitcom How I Met Your Mother. Here's a clip.
Great job, guys. At least we're not keeping score, right? No idea what the score is. Could be 53-0. Could be some other score. It's 53-0.
What are we doing wrong, coach?
You know what? You're not doing anything wrong. It's great that you guys are losing. Because in life, it doesn't matter how much effort you put in or how hard you try, people will just give you things like diplomas and jobs and promotions. So it doesn't matter what you do out there as long as you have fun.
Okay, that's just a moment from the show How I Met Your Mother. But of course, there's another side as well. Kids are specializing in sports at younger and younger ages. Some people take children's sports incredibly seriously. And someone who's concerned about that is with us right now. John O'Sullivan is the founder of the Changing the Game Project. And welcome back to the show, John.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. And I think we've all seen, if you have kids and they've been involved in sports, we've probably all seen both extremes. You know, there can be maybe it's a rec league, maybe it's a neighborhood league where the kids go out there, they have fun, and there's not an emphasis on keeping score. There's not an emphasis on winning. Maybe there's not even much of an emphasis on learning fundamentals. At the same time, there are club sports going on all over the country where at early ages, kids are encouraged to get very serious about their sport and learn the fundamentals and get very serious about winning as well. And that's a culture that really worries you. What do you feel has gone wrong here?
Well, I think what's gone wrong is that the way that sports are run on the youth level, so let's say age 12 on down, has become separated from what are really best practices, right? When is, you know, when do you need to develop kids? When do you need to teach certain things? What do you teach them at what ages and stages? When does it become important to travel? When does it become important that the result matters more than the effort and the learning process? And so because we've separated the best information from how sports is run, we now get these two extremes, right? The extreme of, like, the clip you just played where, you know, nothing matters, you know, don't keep score, give everyone a trophy, which isn't right. And then on the other extreme, hyper early specialization, cutting 7-year-olds, ranking 5-year-old baseball players, and saying that this and that's not right either. And so we need to get back to what does the good science and information say and find that good middle ground.
Now, with and we'll talk about some of the science, because I know that that's something you have specialized in looking at. But when it comes to youth sports, of course, there's a need for a lot of coaches. And there aren't necessarily a lot of people available who want to give their time to coaching. I mean, what gives you the qualification to be a coach of a youth sport?
Well, this is, I think, a huge issue all across the country and across many, many sports, is that in these introductory ages where kids are first starting to play, most kids are working with a volunteer coach. And again, those coaches are donating their time and their energy. Some of them know a lot about a sport. Some of them know very little about the sport. But I think as a whole, we don't do a great job helping those coaches to help the kids. What we do is, you know, so many rec departments that I meet say, oh, what is the bare minimum that we can ask these coaches to do in terms of coaching education? And that's all we'll require. And so what happens is you get the people who don't think they need any education, and everyone does this bare minimum. And now as states are starting to introduce things like, oh, you have to do an hour online course on concussions, you have to do an hour online course on first aid, or you have to do an hour online course on bullying, all of a sudden we start mandating only these little things like concussion, not that concussions are a little thing, but we don't actually teach people how to coach, how to teach a game, but more importantly, as your previous guest was talking about, how do you communicate with people, especially kids, so that they understand that their worth as a person is not based upon how well they dribble a basketball or kick a soccer ball.
So how do you think coaches should prepare?
Well, first of all, I think we need to certify every coach in every sport, regardless of whether they're a volunteer or not. What we do now is, I think, equivalent to sending, you know, we send our, if you send your kids to a pool and the lifeguard knew how to swim but didn't know CPR, you'd be like, well, I'm not sending my kids to that pool. That's not safe. Well, right now we send kids to sports fields where they can swim, but they don't know the ins and outs. And so I think every program across the country has to mandate some level of coaching education. And the younger the kids are, the less knowledge of the game matters, and the most important thing is, what is the impact of my words on these kids? I have to be patient. I have to understand that it's hard to learn. I have to understand that I'm going to have a variety of levels and abilities on my team. And then we also have to educate parents that there's nothing wrong with your DNA because your 7-year-old is struggling to figure out where to be on the soccer field. That's okay. They're supposed to. Everyone learns at a different pace and a different stage. And right now we're in such a hurry to make our kids' games look like the adult games that what happens is we ramp up the pressure on kids, we ramp up our kids' anxiety, and 3/4 of them walk away from sports by the time they're 13.
I'm talking to John O'Sullivan. He's the founder of the Changing the Game Project. We're talking about coaching culture this hour, and we'll get to kids' developmental stages and how that relates to sports and to coaching as well in a few minutes. But we also want to hear from you and about your experiences with coaches in your life. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. Carolyn is on the line in Coralville. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello, Charity.
Hi, and you have a very special coach in your past. Can you tell us about this?
Yes, I was very, very tall, head and shoulders taller than even the boys. I was very, very heavy and was bullied quite a bit at school. The children would say, fatty, fatty, 4x4. I had just left parochial school and gone into the public school system. I didn't know anybody. I didn't have any friends. My mother was dying of cancer. I had a lot on my plate. I felt very beleaguered. And my physical education teacher slash basketball coach at the junior high school took one look at me and said, I think you're a basketball player. And she taught me the fundamentals of the game. She made me into a player, and I started playing for the team. And she didn't say, you're too tall. She said, your height's a real advantage. And she didn't say, you're really overweight. She said, honey, nobody's going to post up on you in the lane. And she taught me how to play and how to win, and most importantly, the big life lesson, how to lose, figure out why, and try again. And so Billie Jean Smith made my life. She saved my life. And the kids at school, instead of saying, fatty, fatty, 4x4, were saying, hey, Carolyn, saw you play the other afternoon. Good game. And I just got all my self-esteem from that. And she was hard at times, very hard on us, and she never gave us freebies. If you got an attagirl from Coach Smith, you knew you had really done something. And she was good with criticism, too. She let you know what you'd done wrong. But she really changed my life.
Oh, Carolyn, thank you so much for sharing that story with us today.
And I was 13, so I was coming into sports at a time that most of the kids today
are exiting. Right. Right. Oh, that's such an important point. Again, thank you, Carolyn. And John, you know, Carolyn's point there about the fact that most kids are exiting sports because they're feeling discouraged by the time they turn 13. Now, when Carolyn was coming up, you could enter a sport at that age.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I hear, you know, I cringeworthy stories of parents who tell me I was trying to sign up my 9-year-old for baseball, and they told me, oh, it's too late if he hasn't been playing for 3 years already. And that's crazy because, you know, 2 years ago the playoff MVP was Lorenzo Cain of Kansas City, and he started playing baseball as a sophomore in high school. So it's just, again, you know, her story is an amazing story because it really articulates the power that a coach has, right? A coach can impact more people in a year than some people get to impact in their lives. And I don't think a lot of coaches realize, even when you're a volunteer, how tremendously impactful everything you say and everything that you do is on the kids that you're in charge of. It's not just a game. It's your words matter, your actions matter. And so, I mean, that's an amazing story. And I when you hear her story, you think about how many kids don't get the opportunity to have that narrative anymore because they only found their athletic ability later on in life.
You know, when I was talking to Coach Jake from UNI a few minutes ago, he was quoting his grandpa and said, well, as a coach or as a father, this is important. And that kind of struck me because the role that a coach plays is not, obviously teachers need to be nurturing, but it's not the same as the role of a teacher. You kind of cross a personal line there. How would you describe the role of a coach?
Well, we are teachers and we're also mentors and we're also role models. You know, this is what we know from research. What do kids want from a coach? This is research by Amanda Visick from George Washington University. Kids want respect and encouragement. They want a positive role model. They want clear, consistent communication. They want it to be okay to make mistakes. And they want someone who knows what they're talking about. They want knowledge of the game. And I think when we look at that as coaches, we can go down that list and say, is this what I give to my players? And again, sort of to get back to your first question, the problem is as soon as you start using words like create an environment of love and respect, people go, you know, you're just not competitive. And that's not true at all. You know, Coach Jake, I listened to his interview. Obviously, they had a great season. that sounds like an environment of love and respect with his players. I don't have to raise my voice. I'm helping them become young, good functioning human beings as well as basketball players. So giving a kid confidence is not being uncompetitive. Creating an environment based on love is not being uncompetitive. It's actually the way to be more competitive. And really what people have to realize, regardless of what level you coach or as a parent, there's only two possible environments, an environment of love or an environment of fear. That's all there can be. And think about your own life. Do you work well in an environment of fear, right? If every day, you came on the radio and it's like, if I have a bad show, I'm getting fired. You know, you're not going to have your best show. You're going to be worried. If you're a salesperson, you're like, if I don't make a sale today, I'm losing my job. Well, if you bring that down to kids who think, if I make a mistake, I'm getting pulled out of this game, then they're going to make more mistakes than if it's like, hey, coach loves me and he's okay or she's okay when I make mistakes.
We want to review a little bit some of the work you've done on specialization, because as you mentioned, there are kids that, okay, I want to play baseball or I want to play basketball when I'm in junior high, and get told, well, if you don't already know how to play, you can't join the team. So what have you learned about the benefits of the kind of early specialization that we see with kids playing club sports when they're in elementary school, for example?
Well, those are two separate questions. Playing a club sport and specializing is not the same thing.
Okay, and why don't you define it for us?
Well, specializing prior to the age of 12, which has been proven through medical research to increase injury rates 70 to 90% and increase burnout and dropout rates and increase psychological issues. That is playing one sport and only one sport year-round, oftentimes with no time off. And what the medical people tell us is that's terrible on a young, growing body. Number two, you only develop skills in that specific area, and you don't develop all-around athleticism. And the one thing about all-around athleticism is that later on, if you're going to achieve an elite level or a college level, being an all-around athlete helps with injury prevention. It helps with strength and conditioning. It helps in so many other areas of your life. So if you have only developed in soccer and you can't catch or throw, you have different parts of your life that don't work well together. And so so everyone going all in on one thing really young, it's just that there's nothing that backs it up outside of gymnastics and figure skating, where if you think your kid's going to be an Olympian, will they hit their athletic peak at 13, 14, 15, 16 years old on the female side? But those are the only sports that really show that putting all your hours in really, really young is the best path going on.
All right, so the benefits of early specialization are very questionable in most sports. I'm curious about the developmental stages that kids go through. Is there an age where they sort of start to be coachable? Because when you look at a soccer team full of three-year-olds who are running around in a clump, they're not particularly coachable.
Well, yeah, exactly. And so, again, helping coaches understand what kids' psychosocial needs are at specific ages is really, really important. Six-year-olds run around in a clump, and coaches say to me, well, how do I get rid of the clump? I'm like, you don't. You can't. They don't have the same perception of the outside world as we do. There's nothing wrong with those kids. That's just the world they live in. I say, if you put, 8 6-year-olds in a room and give them one toy, you think they're going to fight over it? Of course they are. Well, this is what you're doing in soccer at that age. So it's okay. There's nothing wrong with it, which is exactly why your game should have very small numbers on the field, 3 against 3. And you don't need goalkeepers, and you don't need things like that. But, I mean, I think the biggest thing is, and your previous question, sadly, right now, there are advantages to early specialization that parents deal with, which is, if my kid specializes early, he or she gets into the developmental pipeline, right? They get the best coaching, they make the best team because they put all their hours into this. But what happens at puberty for kids is all of a sudden some kids grow, some kids don't. You become your adult athlete. And that kid, that baseball kid who went all in on baseball from age, you know, 6 to 11, 6 to 12, all of a sudden is in high school and doesn't make the high school baseball team because guess what? He's just not a good enough athlete.
And we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to John O'Sullivan. He's the founder of the Changing the Game Project. We're talking about coaching culture this hour on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about coaching culture in the United States. We're focusing right now on youth sports. And if you have some experience with a great coach or maybe a not a great coach in your past, or if you have questions about the kind of coaching that your kids have been experiencing, you're welcome to give us a call. 866-780-9100 is the number. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me this hour, John O'Sullivan. He is the founder of the Changing the Game Project. And John, just before the break, we were talking about developmental stages that kids go through and their ability to be coached at these different levels. And we had to take a little break in the midst of our conversation. You were talking about how, yeah, okay, a bunch to 6-year-olds are going to go out on a soccer field and chase the ball around in a little clump, and that's okay. I mean, we really struggle with that, with understanding what kids are ready to learn, don't we?
We do, and again, we played the full version of high school football, or maybe we even played a college sport, and we watch them on TV, and then we look at our kids' version, and we want it to look like the adult version far too quickly. And what we're learning about sport and kids' development in sport is that they learn better and they learn quicker in smaller games. So, yeah, when I was a kid in first grade or second grade, we went straight to 11-a-side soccer. But now we know far better that that doesn't teach kids as quickly. It doesn't develop them as quickly. And they don't enjoy it as much. So now we play 3-a-side and 5-a-side and 7-a-side. And we don't play bigger games until kids are 12. And again, there's a lot of research behind why we do this. We're starting to see this in hockey. We're starting to see this in basketball. We're starting to see this in lacrosse. So I think it's a really good thing that in these team sports, we're breaking the game down to a game that fits the needs and the values and the priorities of kids. Winning has a place. Of course it does. You want your kids to try their best, to focus, to compete hard. But in my experience, and there, you know, I've been around games as a professional athlete, a college athlete, and then a coach, Division I college coach, and a youth coach. Especially young kids, no matter how the game goes, about 5 minutes after, they're over it, right? They've moved on. It's usually the adults who can't move on to the score of the game.
We're talking about coaching culture this hour, and I want to bring somebody into the conversation who has a lot of experience with coaches as an athlete. Jackie Doherty Knight of Cedar Rapids grew up in Belmont, Iowa, where she played volleyball and basketball, but her favorite sport was softball, which she played all the way through college. Hi, Jackie.
Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
And
as an athlete who played softball all the way through college, you obviously committed a lot of time to the sport. What role would you say that coaches played in your life as a young person?
Well, you know, a lot of mentoring. When I think of softball, I think of the coach that I had from when I was little up until I graduated. And he's been in my life like ever since, and that would be Mr. Howard Dorman. And what I think of him, I think of like a grandfather figure, a mentor, somebody that wants to see you succeed on and off the field, somebody who will put in the time and effort like he did to make sure that you succeed. It didn't matter if, you know, one person showed up to practice in the off season or if it was 20 of us, because pitchers and catchers can report during the winter. And since I pitched, you know, I was with him quite a bit, and, you know, he would just put in the hours, didn't matter how long a night. So knowing that there was that commitment from him helped me as an athlete want to succeed even more.
Now, the commitment that a coach makes that it sounds like you're saying that makes a real difference as to how successful they are. But coaches with that level of commitment come in a lot of different styles. How would you describe Coach Dorman? What was his approach?
Well, it was very blunt. It was very direct, which I think is why he was such a successful coach, because he wasn't playing with any emotions or playing favorites. It was do this. You know, it was very black and white. He really respected the game, and you knew that. So I feel like the knowledge that he had made you even want to work harder. You know, he just put in a lot of time and effort and went to a lot of clinics, and he was National Coach of the Year. So it's like you knew that what he was teaching you was something that was going to, you know, work and stick. So that was always a big motivation for me.
Can you tell me a story about him that kind of will give us a little insight into what he was like?
Well, he's very funny. So, but he's very dry. So, and you may not find the humor in this. I guess you got to kind of know him, but he, you know, if you were standing at the plate and during a game and you might have got two strikes on you right away or something and you didn't swing, he might call a timeout and try to take your bat from you. And then you'd be like, what are you doing? And he'd be like, well, you're not swinging. You don't need your bat then. You know, you're not expected to swing if you don't have a bat. So, you know, stuff like that where he gets his point across and you're like, oh, okay, got it. Or, you know, he might yell at you when you're up to bat if you didn't swing, and he'd say, stop standing up there with your teeth in your mouth. And you'd look at him like, what does that even mean? You didn't even know what it meant, but it was just like, okay, sounds good. I mean, he had stories that he could, you know, relate to anything, and, it, you know, he might yell at you and you might take it a little harsh, and then he'd crack a joke and you lighten the mood, but yet you'd know the point that he was getting across.
Do you still think about things you learned from him?
Oh, gosh, yeah, all the time. He, you know, my sisters and I all played for him, and my mom and her sisters played for him. So he's basically been in our family, I feel like, for my whole life. He's somewhat of a grandfather figure, and we always sit around and talk about, you know, the funny stories or the things that he did, or, you know, it's just, I can't even begin to describe how much his coaching ability has led to my personal life and how successful I've been because of him. You know, he's taught a lot of life lessons on and off the field, and it's just, and more so even about family and how important family is and spending time with them. So it's just, he's just an all around great guy that I was able to fortunately connect with. And I feel like I was successful in softball because of that man. So that's always a thing I'll always cherish about him.
Have you done any coaching yourself?
You know, I did about probably 10, 15 years ago for elementary girls for softball. And I did that for a couple of years. And, you know, I enjoyed it, but I feel like I know my personality. And you have to know your personality to whether you think you're, you know, self-aware to be a good coach or not. And I just really, like, I played the game well, but I don't know if I could really coach it well. So I had more fun with the girls and probably teaching them fundamentals, but I really don't really have any desire to coach, to be honest. I'd rather kind of sit back and watch the plays go on, because I don't have much of a backbone. I don't have much thick skin. And, you know, these days you get a lot of criticism, and I just don't think I could take that. So,
do you feel like the sports culture around young people has changed since you were a kid and made it harder for coaches?
I think so. Absolutely. Yes. I just, you know, I have an 8-month-old, so I really haven't, you know, been in it as a parent side. But when I played, I really don't feel like parents were as harsh or cruel. They were involved, but in a way to have fun and make their kid and the kids around them better, whereas now I feel like it's kind of cutthroat. I mean, for lack of a better term, you know, not all parents, not all circumstances, but I just feel like the kids are just pushed so hard these days. And back when I played, it was just more, it was like, you're pushed hard, but you're also having fun with it too. So, and, you know, like I said, I'm not in it on the parent side, but from what I see from my lens, yeah, I feel like it's really changed.
Jackie, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking me. It was fun.
Jackie Doherty, Knight of Cedar Rapids, and she was talking about a special coach in her life. You're welcome to share your stories with us as well at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. John O'Sullivan is with me, the founder of the Changing the Game Project. And John, Jackie brings up an important point. We've been talking about coaches. We also have the parents who are in this equation as well. And you do see some parents who misbehave at games or even at practice who want the coach to push harder or, you know, get a little too caught up in winning. But as a parent, let's say you don't like how your kid is being coached, not necessarily because you aren't winning enough, but you don't see that kind of environment that you want based on love and respect. Can a parent step in? Can you make changes? Should you try?
Well, I think, you know, and I actually just today we published a blog on changingthegameproject.com called our, you know, is your kid's coach a bully? Because this is a big issue in schools and sport now. And there are coaches who are bullies. And I think, first of all, people have to recognize that there's different levels, right? Some coaches are rude. They coach sarcastically. They say things. They have no intent to harm. They just don't realize they're doing it. That's rude. Some coaches are mean, right? Once in a while, everyone, you know, they'll say something that is insulting and it's intentional and they know it hurts kids. But then, and then some coaches are bullies, and being a bully is repetitively over and over in a relationship that has this imbalance of power, just tearing into kids and doing stuff. Now, as all your guests have said here, there's nothing wrong with a coach having high expectations. There's nothing wrong with a coach being demanding or telling you like it is. And I 100% agree with that. But the coaches who are able to do that because they've built this bond of love and trust, and so they can say things that are difficult to players to help them get better. But deep down, those players know that they love them. So to answer your question, then, as a parent, you really have to look at that coach and say, is this guy just rude? Is she just mean? Or is this truly a dangerous bullying situation? If your kid is not playing their favorite position, tough luck. Deal with it for a season. If your kid is maybe not starting every game and they're used to, tough luck. Deal with it. But if your kid is coming home crying because the coach called them fat or called them slow or are really degrading and demeaning them. If you see a coach doing, you know, throwing a ball at someone when they don't think they're listening, things like that, yeah, then I think as a parent you have to step in. And that's not, you know, there are times when it crosses the threshold from, hey, this is a difficult situation, but it's a good learning experience, to this is a dangerous situation for my kid that can have repercussions far beyond the field.
We have a caller online, Stuart, in Carroll County. Hi, Stuart.
Hello. Thank you for taking me.
Yeah, and you want to talk about a wrestling coach of yours?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was in high school my freshman, sophomore year, the just physically taxing part of the – we had two-a-days for the whole season, and I would tell people all the time that my wrestling season was more physically tough than even basic training in the – Army. And I think that he's kind of a no excuses type of coach, and we would do shuttle sprints in every at the end of a very long practice, and we would have to do faster times for each sprint, and no matter how many times it took us to do, and it would kind of teach us to push more mentally through the things, and how, you know, he'd give rewards for not missing a practice for the entire season, for the 2 days, for the whole 4 months, and everything, and just kind of how the lessons that he taught about pushing through more mentally helped with the military and everything.
So you feel like you still draw on that experience today?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, Stuart, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And, you know, what I'm hearing from so many people, John, is just how incredibly influential a coach can be in their lives. And in listening to Stuart talk about the time commitment that he had to give to wrestling, I mean, that was probably the thing he did more than anything else when he was in high school.
Yeah, exactly. And again, you know, as a kid or as a, you know, young adult doing a sport, when you're in an environment and you're working towards your potential and you're working towards your dreams and your goals, that's enjoyment. And I think as he is saying as well, you know, when you're pursuing enjoyment, that's one of the essential ingredients of any sport experience. It doesn't have to be pleasurable in the moment, right? Your 150th push-up doesn't mean that feels great. If you're a runner and you're training for a marathon, miles 22 through 26 probably don't feel so good. But you still gain enjoyment from chasing after something that really means a lot to you. And that is true happiness. And that's what we have to bring back to sport, that you can have difficulty and enjoyment at the same time. Sadly, many people think that if sport is enjoyable, it's no longer competitive. And that couldn't be further from the truth.
At the same time, I can imagine that sometimes it's easy for a coach to feel like the sport is the most important thing in a kid's life when there's a lot of other stuff going on there, too. Is there a fine line you have to walk?
There is, and I think that's one of the biggest challenges of being a coach is that not everyone there on your roster is there for the same reasons that you're there. and recognizing that each individual has different needs and different things that they want out of this experience and doing your best to give them those things within the team environment. They still have to meet the team expectations. They still have to show up and practice and work hard and all these things. But, yeah, the fact is, even if you're a college coach, you'll have athletes who, you know, their goal for being in college is to become a doctor, to become a teacher. Your sport is secondary, yet that's your life, that's your salary, that's putting food on your table. Nothing's more important than how soccer practice goes, but for your kid, it might be more important that they have a midterm tomorrow. And so just recognizing that is really, really important.
All right. And of course, when you're growing up, there's a lot of stuff going on outside of the playing field as well. John O'Sullivan, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you guys for having me on again. I appreciate it.
John O'Sullivan is the founder of the Changing the Game Project. We've been talking about coaching culture this hour on Talk of Iowa. The show is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Dennis Reese. I'm Charity Nebbe. You can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter @IPRTalk. I'm there @CharityNebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.